This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 44, and I'm your host, Simon Baron. My mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases, and other related events. Now please check out my other podcast, it's called Past Lives Podcast, and it looks into evidence of the afterlife. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe. This week I'm talking to Steve Aspin about his book, Out of Time, The Intergenerational Abduction Program Explored. Steve has had lifelong ET contact experiences and over time has built relationships with leading researchers during his years of investigating this phenomenon. From stumbling upon a cattle mutilation in Ireland in 1970 to witnessing a UFO after a period of missing time at the age of 16, in his book, Steve relates a lifetime of anomalous experiences. Hi, Steve. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Hi, Simon. Good to be with you.
So we're going to be talking about your book, Out of Time, The Intergenerational Abduction Program Explored.
So yeah.
This is intergenerational, and it's about your story and your family. So how far back does this go?
Yeah, it's what I do in the book is I take my own personal story as a launching pad and explore the alien abduction phenomenon, which is not confined to me. It's confined to between 150 million and 400 million people worldwide. And there's about between 2% and 5% of the global population involved in it. And what I do in this book is I start off with my personal story and my childhood and youth and young adulthood before I really came to terms with what was going on and this particular phenomenon might be responsible for it. And then we leap off into the alien abduction phenomenon itself and what it is about, what it seems to be about. And I use my personal experience tied in with historical case data. And I've talked to maybe 40 or 50 abductees over the past 15 years and taken their stories and woven them into the narrative. And I've also talked to a number of other researchers and people. I spent a lot of time with like Timothy Good and Tim and Nick Pope and Bud Hopkins, you know, and people like that. And I took all these relationships and all this material, all these understandings, and melded it together into this book. So I've tried to make it engaging and interesting, and I've tried to make it like a little bit novelistic in that it's a little bit like a journey where I start off in one place and take the reader by the hand and take it to a conclusion, as something like a conclusion. So it's more like a narrative, novelistic journey rather than a fact, you know, one fact after another and one case after another. I didn't want to write that kind of book. I think there's a lot of what is often termed confessional abductee literature around if you look on Amazon or any number of other retail websites, there's maybe 100 books and 150 books on alien abductions. And there's a lot of what I call what's usually called confessional abductee literature. So the abductee says this happened to me and that happened to me and this happened to me and that happened to me as a child and so forth. And they write down their own story and they stop there and they don't really extend it to what that says about the phenomenon, what's happening to them. So what I'm trying to do in Out of Time is say, take the reader by the hand and lead them through the process of what this phenomenon is really at core, what is really going on. So, I think the result is quite successful, but, you know, it's that's for people to judge, you know, when they read it.
Well, I found it a fascinating book. In the title, it says Abduction Program. So what do you mean by that?
Well, when I was, this happens a lot to abductees. When I was about 10 years old, I asked the abductors, which I, at the time, I had no idea that it was, the origin of it was extraterrestrial or was anything to do with aliens. I just thought it was to do with, you know, what I sometimes call the Magonia stuff, which is how my grandmother added it up in the first half of the 20th century, because she was born in 1908 and she died in 1968 at age 60, obviously. And I think the one lengthy conversation I had with her about it was she had cloaked it in the fairy pixie folklore reference. That was the framework of reference that she built around it for her to basically to live with it and understand it. Because in the first half of the 20th century, nobody really had any idea that this was extraterrestrial, but it is. That's my contention that it is 100% extraterrestrial in origin. Some people still believe that it's something else, you know, which, you know, they may be right, but I don't think so. When I was about 10, I asked one of the abductors why they were doing this to me. And this is a question that many abductees have framed to the abductors. And he just said a really bored, offhand sort of way, you know, that they have, because they talk to you telepathically directly into your mind. He just said, oh, it's because of your mother and your grandmother and your great grandmother. And you're the fourth one in the line. And that's why we've got to do this to you. And he just got on with what he was doing. And he was really matter of fact about it. You were just discussing a shopping list, basically. And I did ask my grandmother about this that same year. And she said, oh, Stevie, they're just the pixies. They're the pixies. Don't worry, they'll always bring you back. And she just settled to the abduction issue and, wanted to reassure, you know, her grandchild that basically he didn't have to worry about it too much. And I think, you know, as I looked into the program in midlife and later, it is a program that I think the thing originated in between 1890 and 1900, during that decade, maybe a couple of years either side of that, maybe it was the late 1880s, but it's around about that period. And I do bring a fair amount of evidence to the table about the early days of the program, which, you know, we have very, very little hard evidence to go on, because I think basically in the 1890s globally, a lot of the first generation of abductees were functionally illiterate, because widespread literacy was not by no means universal, even in the UK and in other parts of Europe and North America. It was, you know, the education was really basic. So I think the early abductees may have been selected at random. But there may have been other criteria used. We just don't know that. Some abductees are told that something was released into the atmosphere or was released into the population, and certain people responded to it in a certain way, and they were just picked up and chosen for the program. And some people reckon it's basically was it is pretty much random. I think all the first generation of abductees were young adults at the start of their breeding years, that, you know, between 15 and 25 years old, something like that. And after that, at least one of their children was chosen for continuation in the program, and one of their children and one of their children, and maybe more than one, but certainly one of each. Sometimes it goes down. This is very difficult to be definitive about, but there are branches of a family that get abducted, and brothers and sisters often get abducted and so forth. And sometimes only one sibling seems to experience this, and the others not. So it's very difficult to generalize about it, but it's definitely intergenerational. And people who now are having abduction experiences in the 21st century, they all, without exception, I think, had at least one great-great-grandparents or great-grandparents in the program. And it's gone down the generations, and it's still happening to them.
So do you think that maybe they're doing some kind of genetic engineering very subtly, like your DNA could have been fiddled with?
A lot of people believe that's the case. I don't have any evidence for that specifically. So I'm just assuming in chapter 8 in the book, when I talk about what it's like being an abductee and how many abductees there are in the population, and why do some abductees know they're abductees and most don't, are completely unaware of it. And what's the intergenerational components? How does that work? And, are these people being genetically modified? I mean, I talk about the difference between, males and females. As an example, females have born with maybe 700,000 mature oocytes. That's over when they're little girls, when they're newborn, and they never produce any more. All the egg cells are in the infant baby girl, whereas sperm production doesn't begin until the boy's in his teens. So there's something about the way this genetic thing interacts that it seems like they know what they're doing in that. It's very, very complicated and difficult to explain. And even if I understood it, completely, which I don't understand it any more than most abductees do, but there is a component, an intergenerational component, and there is some kind of genetic thing going on. Beyond that, we really can't speculate.
So there's this side of the genetic engineering, but there's also this idea of hybrids, and there may be genetic engineering there.
There may be. I mean, people reported in the 1980s, particularly in the 70s and 80s, abductees reported that they were seeing fetuses generation in tanks of fluid, like newborn babies in little brown containers full of brown fluid. And they speculated that this was they were breeding some kind of hybrid race. Now, this is again a big subject. I think that part of the program might be at an end now. They might not be producing babies in that way, but they were doing it certainly for 20 or 30 years, and there's a lot of reports of this.
You worked with Dr. David Jacobs.
Yeah, for a few years. I was introduced to David by Bud Hopkins. I always knew about him. I listened to a BBC Radio 4 interview with Dr. John Mack in the 1990s when, as you know, John was killed in London in 2004, I think, one night when he was hit by a drunken driver because he looked the wrong way because he was an American, and he stepped off the curb and looked left instead of right. And during that interview with John Mack, he mentioned to me, he mentioned that to the interviewer that David Jacobs was another academic that was looking into this phenomenon as he was. He was a psychiatrist from Harvard, and David was a history professor at Temple University in Philadelphia. And he actually ran the only fully accredited course in UFOs of any American university for 25 straight years. And so he's always had an interest in the phenomenon, and he got drawn into the subject much later in his UFO interest. And it was the 1980s before he started to look into this phenomenon. But I'd heard of him way back in the 90s from this interview with John Mack. I didn't meet him until 2008. And he offered to work, when I visited him in Philadelphia, he offered to work with me on my experiences, which was very unusual because I was basically really fortunate just to be at the right place at the right time, because he was having 1,000 to 1,500 people a year contacting him through his website or writing him letters, asking him to work with them. And he couldn't take everybody on because the numbers was so enormous. So I was very, very lucky, very fortunate that he offered, you know, to work with me just because I happened to be visiting him and we kind of hit it off, you know, and he could tell that, you know, I was troubled by the experiences and I also needed to get to the bottom of it. So we started working together in January 2009, and we worked together until 2016, at which time I withdrew somewhat. And although we continued to speak fairly regularly on the phone, I didn't really have any more sessions. And then in 2018, he finally retired. Basically, he'd retired from university life in 2011 after 35 years as a professor of history, and he stopped working with abductees at the end of 2018. So he's still with us, but he's just past his 80th birthday now, and he doesn't do this anymore.
And so, how many of the memories that you've written about in the book were recovered under hypnosis?
I would say none of them, but it's not quite true. But it's almost none. The book is structured in such a way that the first chapter, the prologue in the first chapter is called A Slow Revelation. And that's basically from infancy until I was 50 years old, I had certain standout incidents that should have been markers that this was happening to me. Like I came face to face with some gray aliens in a hotel room in Sardinia, and I was fully awake and fully conscious. And one of them put a screen memory in my mind. This is what they can do. That he was my father, and all I could see was my dad, who had died 3 years earlier, and he was vivid and technicolor and smiling and right in front of me. And they can. This is another part of the phenomenon. They can distract you and make you think that you're experiencing something that you're not quite experiencing. And other two gray aliens, one on each side of this image of my father, I thought, what are they doing there? I mean, if this is a visit from the other world, like, you know, my dad's coming back to tell me he's okay, why are those creatures next to him? And are they where he now is, you know, in the realm he's now living? And I just couldn't really understand that. But I took away from that experience a life after death, you know, visitation, you know, as some sort of past life visitation that my dad was that was coming back to see me. I didn't take away from it that this was an abduction experience. What it actually was the end of an abduction experience where I came to and they were in the room. And still in the room when basically the paralysis and the control wore off, and they just put that image in my mind to placate me, and they left. There was that instance, and there's a whole load of other incidents that I detail. One, you know, during that chapter, to take the reader on a journey as to how I got to the point where I decided to investigate this, where I could not ignore this any longer. And I finally realized what was probably happening to me. I mean, obviously, you can't be certain you're an abductee, but what was probably happening to me. And I decided to go on a journey to investigate it. And that was only in 2007. So the first chapter is taken up with this life story. And then I weave into the narrative immediately a chapter of seven standout cases from the early history of the phenomenon, where cases like the Allagash case and the Travis Walton case and Betty Andreasen case and so forth, and the Hill case, when there were these particular abductions were rigorously investigated by multiple investigators, and they all had books written about them and reports written about them, and were exhaustively investigated. So, you know, what we have in the public domain is pretty is as sound and solid as any abduction case can be. And I'm assuming that my reader may not know this history of all these abduction cases. And I wanted to introduce the reader to, at a fairly early stage, the fact that this isn't just somebody's personal story. This you can juxtapose with all these other abduction cases that are in the public domain and known about, and about which reports were written. And therefore, you know, we have these two, this twin pillars of evidence, basically, my own life experiences and this body of work that are then used to meld together, and we launch into what's really going on. And from chapter three in the book, I start to talk about the program and what, if you draw together all the evidence of all these cases, you can see common threads and you can see common themes and what event, you know, what we can actually learn from this. And so-and-so thinks this, and, you know, John Mack wrote about that, and Ray Fowler explored this case and so forth. And he thought this, and, you know, Carla Turner thought that, you know, with her Ted Rice case and so forth. And what we can distill down from that and try to understand about what's really going on. And that's when we get into the body of the work. The fourth chapter, without going through every part of the book, the fourth chapter is very important because it concerns physical evidence. What they leave behind is, it's called physical evidence. What they leave behind: scars and scoops, implants and hair. So they basically, abductees wake up in the morning with scars on their bodies, sometimes straight line cuts where they've no idea how these happened. And little scoop marks, which look like a little ice cream scoop of flesh taken out of a part of the body, usually a part of the body that's the abductee doesn't see him or herself, like it's on the back of the shoulder or it's in the back of the leg, the thigh, where they don't normally look at themselves, or they can't look at themselves except in a mirror. But, you know, these things are often noticed by their partners, wives, husbands, other members of the family. And there is, so the whole chapter is about this, the investigation of all of these things that I've undertaken through the years. And there are forensic, medical and scientific reports about a scoop mark, about some hair which was found after an abduction case, and about an implant that was extensively investigated. So this is right at the heart of the book, is this very definite physical forensic scientific evidence right at the heart of the book, which I'm hoping that will kind of sway some people into believing that this is a real thing. And it's not just, well, this happened to me and that happened to me. It's, well, this happened and I've got a scoop mark scar on my shoulder and this is what it looks like. And I was taken to a dermatopathology clinic in Manhattan and had it biopsied and investigated. And this is a report, you know, what this thing is, you know, it's a dermatofibroma, isn't it? And, you know, we go into that, what that actually is medically. And and there are photographs of bodily scarring and bruising and so forth, and burns around the legs. So the physical evidence is right at the core of the book, and it's a kind of important part of the narrative, because I think if you don't have something physically palpable to demonstrate to people, you know, with medical, scientific, forensic evidence that you can lay out on the table, and you can, I can, you know, produce all these reports are printed up in the appendices, A, B, C, and D, about the history of this, of what happened with all this medical, physical evidence, and the labs that reported on it and investigated the implants and so forth. It's absolutely at the core of the book, you know, and it's that in some ways it sets it apart from a lot of books about the abduction issue, because they're not all so forensically and scientifically grounded as this. So I really try to have that to be a major focus right at the core of the narrative.
And you talk about times when there's kind of a compulsion to go somewhere. And that happened to you when you were 16?
Yeah, it did, actually. That's one of the things that happens in the book about the program. There's 35 separate different things that happen to abductees in their lives that I list and go into a little bit. And I say that if you're part of this program, then some of these will apply to you and you'll immediately recognize them. And for some abductees, it will be maybe 10 or 15 other different ones, you know, from this long list. When I was 16, this forms the prologue of the book. I had an experience that was so totally undeniable and so physical and so troubling that I could never really let go of it for the rest of my life. It's always something. What happened was I was I was working at an agricultural nursery during the summer between high school and college. And for 2 months, I worked 6 days a week, Sunday through Friday. And the only day I didn't work was Saturday. And on the 20th of July, which was 1972, which was coincidentally the third anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing, which is on the 20th of July, 1969. I don't actually think there's any significance in that. It just happens to be the anniversary. Yeah. I had it was a Thursday evening, and I've had a very powerful compulsion to wake up the following Saturday morning, which was 2 days from that point. And I was to go somewhere. And this sounds very peculiar if I describe it now, but at the time I just felt, oh, yeah, I've got to go somewhere. And I woke up on Saturday morning, which I usually slept in on the Saturday mornings because it was the only day when I didn't start work at 8 o'clock in the morning in the nursery. And I put my clothes on and went out the front door. And we lived in a suburban middle-class neighborhood and on the edge of farmland. So we lived in a large village stroke small town, right on the edge of a large village stroke small town. And nearby was the countryside with cows and corn and so forth. And about a mile from home, some new houses were being constructed, maybe about 20 or 30 of them. And I walked to this place determinedly. I knew this was where I was supposed to go. And I remember getting there, and it was a bright sunny morning, absolutely clear skies, about 5 o'clock in the morning. It was 5 to 6. It's 5:55 in the morning, so nearly 6 o'clock in the morning, and the sun was up. And I remember getting to this place and thinking, okay, now what? And suddenly everything changed. I realized I was in a maybe 10 or 15 meters away from where I was standing a fraction of a second before, and I was surrounded by blue and indigo pulsating lights and a whooshing sound in my ears. And I had no idea what was going on, obviously. And I looked at my watch, which was loose on my wrist. Obviously, this was way before mobile phones, cell phones for our American listeners. And everybody wore wristwatches in those days. And I had a watch on my left wrist. And it was slack, like the strap wasn't done up right, which is strange because I just left home and had done it up properly. And it showed 8:15 in the morning. And literally, you know, a second earlier, it seemingly, it had been 5 to 6, and suddenly it was 8:15. And I had this whooshing sounds in my ears and this blue spectral lights pulsating around me. And I looked outside through, I was in a partly built house. It was like a building site. And I was inside the structure, but there was no windows and doors fitted and no roof timbers on it. So there was a rectangular aperture in the wall where the window was to be fitted, but had not at that point been fitted by the builders. And I was looking through this rectangular aperture in front of me, and I saw a flying saucer, maybe, I don't know how far away it was, 80 or 100 meters away and about 30 degrees elevation from the ground. And it was drifting. It was big and bright and in full view, and it was drifting slowly from left to right in my vision. And so this whooshing and spectral lights kept going on. Somebody said in my ear or in my head, "You're not going to remember anything about this. You're going to forget everything that's happened this morning. You're going to forget. So don't think about it. It doesn't matter. There's a rush of things that was in this communication. The sense of it was, it doesn't matter what we tell you. You're not going to remember anything anyway." And suddenly, after this was said to me, the spectral lights all stopped and the flying saucer was gone. And I was kind of back to normal, and it was 8:15. I'd lost 2 hours and 20 minutes of time. Had just gone, just like that, just like snapping your fingers, just disappeared. And I had no memory of anything that happened in that 2 hours and 20 minutes. And I thought, okay, I'll go home now. And, you know, this is very difficult to explain how somebody could have that kind of reaction. But I just decided, I was very puzzled and very troubled by this, but I started walking home. And my left cheek under the eye socket felt wet and like it was burnt. And I put my finger up there and it was kind of weeping. And when I got home, I looked in the bathroom mirror and I could see a coin-sized burn on the cheek, perfectly spherical, like a disc. Like a big coin had been pressed into my cheek, and it was weeping and it was red and it was like a burn. And I thought, what has this got to do with all this? Is this connected to it somehow? And already the flying saucer sighting was kind of fading a bit because they do something to your memory, but it wasn't completely gone. And I didn't know what, I had no idea what on earth to make of this. I mean, in 1972, in suburban Northwest England, it alien abduction was not a thing that anybody knew about, or there was no frame of reference to it at all. And there was no frame of reference to, you know, being aboard flying saucers and so forth. And I really, you know, it seems bizarre, but I just kind of locked it up for years. I just had no frame of reference to fit this in. I think if it happened in the 21st century to a 16-year-old, they would probably know about alien abduction being a thing in the culture. They might have seen a late night Discovery Channel program or something, or they might have read something on the internet. But in 1972, there's nothing. And I just didn't know what to make of it. I didn't know what to do with it. And this injury on my face and my left cheek healed up. It took about 3 months to heal. It, obviously, it scabbed over within a couple of days. And it took maybe 3 months to completely disappear. So what do you make of that?
Well, I've got so many questions. I mean, one thing is, I think you said in the book you met somebody and they had the same thing happen on their face?
That was in 2009. I met someone, another abductee, who lives, I won't say exactly where he lives. He lives in the north of England and he's a senior police officer. And he was a little bit younger than me. But in 2009, I was already in my early 50s. And he had an abduction experience very similar to mine. And he'd had a burn exactly the way I described my burn, for exactly the same size and exactly the same place on his cheek. And I've never met another abductee who's claimed, you know, that this happened to them. And neither he nor I thought to photograph it. I mean, basically in 1972, we didn't have cell phone cameras. And we probably had a camera somewhere in the house with a film in it that my father had, and it was in a drawer somewhere. And I didn't think to photograph it because I didn't really want to kind of, you know, have a record of it, really. It sounds strange, but, you know, abductees, sometimes they're kind of almost ashamed of what's happening to them, and they want to hide it, and they don't really want to go public with this. I mean, the majority of abductees like this. There's a minority of abductees want to go public and think, you know, who believe they're special. The abductors tell them they're special and they've got a message for humanity or whatever. But I didn't really want to pursue it at all. I just wanted to cover it up, and I had no hope of understanding what it was. And I didn't actually connect it to the boyhood abduction incidents with the Pixies, because it was so different in character, you know, whereas they happened at night and were not associated with UFOs or UFO sighting or anything like that. This one was associated with a UFO sighting, and it was a daytime thing. And somehow they chose to take me on a Saturday morning, which was the only time in the 7 day week when I wouldn't be missed. So they knew exactly when that I wouldn't be missed, and they could get me to walk out of the house and put into my mind to go to this place about a mile away. And they could abduct me for 2 hours plus, 2 hours and 20 minutes. And they knew that nobody would notice I was missing.
I read about when you were in Norwich and you were a boy with the family and you were missed that time.
That was, put that in the narrative because I've never really understood it. And I couldn't make any sense of it until I still can't make sense of it because it was, there was no other incident exactly like that. I was holidaying when I was 12 with another boy in my class, my school friend, and he was an only child, and I had another sibling in the family, and they took me to Norfolk and to do some sailing on the Broads and so forth. And one day we're in Norwich, and there was this school friend and me and his parents. And we're looking in a quiet street. So we're looking in a model shop and some aircraft models. And suddenly they grabbed hold of me and said, "Where have you been? Where have you been? We've been worried sick about you. We've been looking everywhere." And they told me, explained to me that I've been gone completely missing for an hour. I just vanished. And for an hour, they couldn't find me anywhere. And they'd asked people in the streets if they'd seen someone of my description. You know, this was before surveillance cameras and shopping malls and so forth. In those days, 1968. And they had looked everywhere for me, and they were tearing their hair out with worry because they thought I might have been abducted by humans, you know, bundled into a car or something. They just couldn't understand how I just disappeared. And then suddenly I was back right next to them. And I could make no sense of this at the time. And I didn't realize, because I'd had, in my experience, it was completely seamless missing time. And I just didn't realize I'd been away. And they told me I'd been away. That was the only reason I knew that I'd gone missing, you know, because this boy and his parents were so frantic, you know, that I'd gone missing for an hour, disappeared completely from view, from sight, from sound, and suddenly I was back. And that's the only other time I couldn't really make any sense of that. I mean, this is just, if this happened to you in 1968, was a 12-year-old, you wouldn't have any framework to fit it into. You wouldn't have anything to, you know, you wouldn't, I mean, they obviously assumed to themselves that I must have run, you know, run off and hidden and been playing stupid games or something. What could they think? What could they think about this other than something like that? I just vanished. And then I was back an hour later. So yeah, that was a bizarre incident, a missing time incident, and which I had no memory.
It just makes me wonder if they're doing it on purpose in a way. They're kind of leaving you with breadcrumbs, leading you down a path to some point in your life later. You'll look back and think, "Hang on a second."
It's an interesting thought, Simon. I actually, that's occurred to me, but I'm a little bit agnostic on it. I'm on the fence about that. I'm not sure that's the way they work. Maybe it is, but I there are so many instances, you know, the reason abductees become aware of what's going on, well, a minority of them do, and the majority don't, is because those who become aware of what's going on have these standout instance where things don't go quite right, or they don't, that, you know, it's not quite secret, you know, that because the program's very covert and we don't know what they're doing or why, but we do know that they take abductees repeatedly and frequently throughout their lives. And they're missing, they're physically missing. And some abductees have an experience where they remember a UFO sighting, or they have an experience where they're with people and they are missed, you know, because they just disappear for a while and then they're back. And some abductees are abducted in groups, like the Allagash case, in Maine. I mean, in 1976, those four adults. Students were abducted as a group, and three of them I believe were abductees in the program, and the fourth one was not. He was just opportunistically taken because they were in a canoe at night. So sometimes they're abducted in groups, sometimes as in the Travis Walton case, the abduction is witnessed, and there are a handful of incidents where abductions are witnessed by by observers, and very, very, very small number, a tiny number in the scheme of things. But it's when these, I mean, if you want to characterize them as mistakes, the little errors or the glitches in the program are what tells the abductee that something is going on. Because when everything goes to plan, they don't notice anything. They don't notice the missing time. If they're asleep, you know, they wake up and they've had a vivid dream, might wake up a little bit late, and they don't notice the missing time. They're not missed by anybody because they've been asleep in a darkened room. And sometimes, very rarely, very occasionally, something happens in an abduction which alerts the abductee to this very peculiar thing that's going on in their lives.
You talk about how you accidentally touched one. There was like a screen memory of your cousin and you reached through it and you touched the ET, and then you felt this telepathic kind of empathy with them, and they felt great fear and anxiety. And that's not something I've ever heard about before.
Yeah, this happened in 2008, an August bank holiday weekend. And I was, by this time, I'd become aware that the abduction thing was happening to me. And I knew that was the source of all the weirdness, all the strangeness. And I was abducted. I was being moved out of the bedroom and moved upwards through the roof of the house. Your listeners that don't understand how this works, you know, they can somehow suspend the atomic structures in matter. I mean, technology is extremely advanced, maybe 2,000, 3,000, maybe a million years ahead of where we are. So they can suspend the atomic structures in matter and move people through windows, through doors, and through walls, and through solid structures, and you're unharmed by this. And the solid structures remain when you pass through. I was being moved upwards, and the two small greys were below me, and one small grey was in front of me. And the small grey who was in front of me made himself look like, at the time, my six-year-old second cousin, you know, who's like my niece, really. And she was six at the time, and I was 51, I think. Obviously, I was seeing her, you know, now and again in the family get-togethers. And they made me... what they do is one of the small greys projects a screen memory over itself, so that's what you see is what they want you to see. And she was smiling and welcoming with open arms, and she had a nightdress on. And I put my arm out to her to touch her, and my arm went straight through and got hold of a skinny grey torso, cold grey torso. And I really immediately realized what was going on. My niece was a screen memory to placate me, to make me feel okay with what was happening. And I grabbed this little grey, and he felt real fear. And I, for some reason, you know, their neurological control sometimes is not 100% effective when the early stages of the abduction. I could feel his fear and anxiety surging through him, and I let go, and he moved off about 5 or 10 meters away. And I first realized that they do feel fear. The small greys feel fear and feel anxiety if they feel their physical safety is threatened.
Is there any evidence about this intergenerational program where it always goes down the mother's side of the family? I mean, does your father have any memories?
I don't think it always goes down the mother's side. I think male abductees have offspring as well. I've met a few, both males and females, of abductees who are certain it's their father that's the origin of the program rather than their mother. I don't really think it's necessarily one parent or the other. It is one parent or the other, but it's not always the mother, no. In the book, I write in chapter 9, there's a story from a Turkish abduction researcher, or a UFO researcher called Farah Yıldızlı, who's also a psychic. And some of your listeners may know Farah. She lives in Istanbul these days, but she used to live in New Jersey. And I've known her for about 15 years. And there's a story in there that I weave into the early stages of the program, when I'm exploring the early stages of the program in the 1890s. She, her great-grandfather had an experience when he was a young man, around about 20. And this great-grandfather was called Emin Refik, and he was a lecturer at the university in Istanbul on a very low salary because he was very young. And I think from what Farah's told me and from, you know, her life story and from the story of her ancestors, definitely that male abductee was the origin in that particular line. And, you know, there's if you read it, it's a relatively complicated story, but if you read the book, you'll pick up where it fits in. And I think sometimes it's the man, sometimes it's the woman. Yeah, it goes down one line or the other.
And what was your mother's viewpoint? Because you said your grandmother talked about pixies and fairies.
I don't think my mother worked out what was going on until she was in her 30s. Although she may have had inklings of it earlier, but she definitely knew something was going on in her 30s. My grandmother cloaked it in, she attached it to the fairy pixie folklore paradigm, you know, the kind of Magonia stuff, because in the first half of the 20th century, before anybody really knew about the abduction program, the abduction program was happening at all, that's what most abductees attach it to. They attach it to the Magonia stuff.
Is that like Jacques Vallée, Passport to Magonia?
Yeah, it was in the 800s. The Bishop of Lyon wrote a treatise that the local peasants believed in sky people who came in sailing boats with sails and banners fluttering out of the sky, and they stole crops and they occasionally stole people. And there was an incident where three men and one woman, were presented in chains to the church authorities, and they were claimed by the people who'd arrested them that they came from the sky and they came from this legendary place called Magonia. And they were finally persuaded to release these people. And that's where this Magonia legend comes from. It's this the Bishop of Lyon in the 8th century. And Jacques Vallée wrote this book, Passport to Magonia, he published in 1969, and that's the title he gave it, Passport to Magonia, because he wanted to associate the UFO thing with the sky people and the fairies and the pixies and so forth. He wanted to attach them together like it was one thing, but it's not actually one thing. It's two completely separate and different things. But, you know, these Magonia ideas have permeated the UFO research community to the degree that they've muddied the waters far too much, in my view, in the view of many people. They've muddied the waters far too much, and they've arrested and retarded understanding of what the abduction program's about.
What do you think about calling it the abduction program or abduction? Because I have interviewed people who say, "Oh no, I don't like calling it abduction."
What do they want to call it?
Because they like to say their experiences.
Oh yeah, that's technically true. I mean, if you go to the Glastonbury Festival every June, you're an experiencer because you experience the festival, and you know, being an experiencer means you experience something, because it happens to you, or you're there, you're witness to it. Abductee is far more specific. It describes basically something involuntary that happens to you. I mean, I don't really, and no abductee that I know can make an appointment, choose when they will be taken. And it's always on the abductor's terms, the abductor's, a time and place of the abductor's choosing. So they're not equal partners in this. It happens to them, and they're subject to it. And I think abductee is more accurate and more specific. The word experiencer is obviously accurate in that they're having an experience, but it's a bit vague for my taste, to be honest. It's a bit too vague. It's a bit too woolly. It's a bit too woo-woo.
And I wanted to ask you about this thing where it was almost like the ETs are gaslighting you. You talk about items in the house disappearing and then appearing days later?
Yeah, you know, that's another thing about the phenomenon. It's not something I've experienced a lot, but I have experienced it a bit. And the person who's really had a huge catalogue of these experiences is Debbie Jordan Cowbell. Do you know who she is?
Yeah, she was a guest on the podcast.
Right, so you obviously know her, and some of your listeners are going to know her as well. And she was the main subject of Bud Hopkins's book Intruders that he published in 1987. Concurrently, as it happens, with Whitley Strieber's Communion, which was published the same year. But Debbie has had an awful lot of things of that kind, of this kind of paranormal stuff going on around her, far more than most abductees that I know have had, although we've all had some of that, a small amount of that, but Debbie has an enormous amount of it. I mean, did she talk to you about the stuff going missing and the you know, the stuff that she found under the carpet when the carpet was nailed down?
Yeah, I think so. She did tell me about the police turning up and saying they'd had a phone call from her address of a woman screaming, and nothing had been happening in her house.
Yeah, she lost her wedding rings one time, and she found it under the bed, underneath the carpet, which was nailed down at all the corners, right in the middle of the carpet, under the carpet. She found it there, and how it, you know, there's no possible way. I mean, that's one of hundreds of incidents that she's endured, you know, as part of her abduction history, which is very complicated. And she, because she's aware of what's been going on with her, she's alert to all such incidents and doesn't dismiss them. You know, she records them and remembers them anyway. So yeah, some abductees have that report that a lot, and some abductees either not at all or very little. But I've had a few things like that going on. My mother claimed that they, you know, which is the title of the last chapter of the book, THEY in quotation marks. She said they have taken the kitchen towels again, or they have taken some knives and forks, or they have taken some of her clothes, and then they'd appear back again a few days later. And I've had some of that happen to me over the years, including a door key which disappeared out of my wallet, and I had to go 30 miles to get a spare key from another relative to get into this house that I was staying in. And when I woke up in the morning, the two keys were sitting next to each other on the dresser and then next to the bed. And, you know, I'd swear to you, one key was completely gone for several hours. So my mother used to report these incidents a lot more than I have experienced. And she was going through this when I was in my teens, between 15 and 18 years old. And I left home at 18 and went to university. And in I left home in Cheshire and went to university in Southampton, which is about 250 miles from Chester. And I didn't, you know, wasn't home every night, obviously. And she continued to experience these things. She, unlike my grandmother, she cloaked it in spiritualism and the occult. And she joined the Spiritualist Association of Great Britain, and she became a spiritual healer, and she had this whole paradigm into which she tried to fit the abduction phenomenon, which didn't include fairies and pixies and didn't include aliens, but it included this spiritual entities, you know, the afterlife and the spiritual entities. She thought it was all to do with that. You see, abductees know that something weird is happening to them, and they use different frameworks to explain it to themselves. And, you know, my grandmother, my mother, and I have all explained it in different ways, you know.
The book is called Out of Time, The Intergenerational Abduction Program Explored, and I'll put links to it in the show notes. And yeah, you have a website?
outoftimebook.info. And if you go to outoftimebook, or one word, .info, you'll find direct links to amazon.co.uk website and the amazon.com website. where you can buy either an ebook or a paperback copy of the book.
Great. And do you have plans for another book?
Not yet. I've been asked that by a number of people, including George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. And he said, I think, Steve, that's for your second book. And I said, you're an optimist, George. I may write another book, but I'm not planning to at the moment. I just, out of time, was only published on the 12th of September this year. So it's only been in the market about a month, 6 weeks now. And it's the demand for it is really strong. And I think I'll be involved with talking about Out of Time for a good many months yet before, you know, the furore dies down. And maybe in 2023 or 2024, I can think about a follow-up work because there's more to say on this subject.
Well, thanks again for coming back.
Thank you, Simon. It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
And that was an interview with Steve Aspin about his book, Out of Time, The Intergenerational Abduction Program Explored. And if you want to hear the rest of this fascinating interview, which is about another 30 minutes, you'll need to sign up to Patreon for the extended episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienUFOpodcast. If you join the $4.50 a month tier, you'll get access to an extended episode every month. If you join the $7.50 a month tier, you'll have access to an extended episode every week. When you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And please check out my other podcast, it's called Past Lives Podcast. There are over 230 episodes. On the Past Lives Podcast, I look into evidence of the afterlife, such as near-death experiences, children with past life memories, mediumship, deathbed visions, and other phenomena. I also release an extra episode of Past Lives Podcast every Thursday, and that's called Paranormal Stories. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and the link is in the show notes. Now, in my work as a clinical hypnotherapist, I take people through past life regression. And when you book a past life regression hypnosis session with me, and you've signed up to Patreon, you get a 25% discount, and I'm offering a free consultation call that can be booked on my website. My Instagram is pastlivespodcast with an underscore between each word, and on Twitter I am at Simon G. Bown. If you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.